evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Luke Haverly, coming to you with the Divided Kingdom Show. Well, lots happening in the world these last few days, and I picked a few things to talk about today that I think are not going to be dated right away, but of great interest. I'm going to begin with something from Zero Hedge, ZeroHedge.com. Make DC presentable again. If you listened at all to the radio or TV, you know that Donald Trump has decided it's time to clean up the nation's capital. This article was by Tyler Durden, Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. On August 11th, 2025, President Donald Trump did something that no other president in modern memory has dared to do. He effectively took over Washington, D.C., and in particular, D.C.'s policing operations. In a sweeping declaration of a public safety emergency, he deployed about 800 National Guard troops, assigned 120 FBI agents to night patrols, and put the D.C. Metropolitan Police under the direct control of Attorney General Pam Bondi. The mission? To clean up the Capitol. Its rising crime rates and, yes, the sprawling homeless encampments that have been swallowing sidewalks and city parks. The reaction from some comers was immediately outrage. How dare the president flex federal muscle in the nation's capital? But for those of us who have actually visited D.C. anytime recently, it's hard not to think, finally. For too long, the capital of the United States, the city that houses the White House, Congress, and the Supreme Court, has looked less like the shining beacon of democracy and more like a live-action hellscape, I should say hellscape, from a horror movie. Tourists and school trips meandering through downtown D.C. learn how the history of our great nation was confronted with makeshift shantytowns, hypodermic needles, and smells worse than J.B. Pritzker's bathroom the morning after a long night at Big Ed's barbecue. For Democrats, who seem just fine with this nightmare, it's been like inviting guests over for dinner, letting someone pitch a dung-filled tent in the middle of your dining room, and then acting offended when guests ask, "Is this really what we're going to eat?" Now, let's be realistic. Federalizing the police isn't going to magically fix the tangled mess of causes behind homelessness. No one's pretending it will. But in politics, as in hosting dinner parties, appearances matter. And in Washington, D.C., the entire city is the stage. When world leaders, diplomats, and tourists step off the plane, they're not just visiting a city. They're seeing America's face. And if that face is covered in human feces, a block from the White House, guess what? They're not going to be thinking, land of the free. They're going to be thinking third world cosplay. I've been to plenty of European capitals, Paris, Vienna, etc. And they all had one thing in common. They were mostly immaculate. Even cities with homelessness managed to keep their central government and tourist districts pristine. Plazas were relatively clean, parks were manicured, and the trash was taken out before it could audition for a permanent role as Hunter Biden's latest piece of conceptual art. Meanwhile, our Capitol has apparently decided that the streets around our most important buildings should double as open-air living rooms. We wouldn't tolerate this outside Buckingham Palace or the Élysée Palace, so why is it fine outside the White House? Is our new national motto, "We tried nothing, and we're all out of ideas"? And this is where Trump's move makes perfect sense. Sometimes you can't wait for the quote-unquote perfect long-term plan to magically appear out of a think tank powerhouse deck. Sometimes you have to make the place look presentable right now. Remember, like we did for Chinese President Xi Jinping when he came to San Francisco. And frankly, it's jaw-dropping that President Biden didn't seem to have enough pride or even basic situational awareness to do anything visible to try and clean up D.C. This is the same ostrich routine we've seen on the border. If you just bury your head in the sand and hum loudly enough, maybe people won't notice the absolute chaos, which begs people to assume gross incompetence, if not an outright goal of single-handedly destroying the country and its image. There's nothing shallow about caring how your country looks. It's not cosmetic. It's called national pride. When visitors, whether foreign dignitaries or American school kids, arrive in Washington, what they see should tell them we are a capable, functioning nation, which respects itself. Right now, what they see too often are screams, "We've given up," and nothing broadcasts, "We've lost control," like a tent city and drug-addicted homeless within selfie range of the White House. So yes, bravo, Trump. You've reminded people that presentation is part of patriotism. In Washington, appearances aren't just about looking good for the cameras. They're about signaling competence, pride, and respect. If that means a show of force to restore order, so be it. Because sometimes, the fastest way to fix a broken system is to start by sweeping the front porch, especially when the front porch happens to be the front porch of America. That, again, was a good article from Zero Hedge. Make D.C. presentable again, Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. Now we turn on to something from the New York Post by Miranda Devine. Trump turns tables on Democrats after years of lawfare. Now it's time to hold them accountable. Again by Miranda Devine, New York Post, August 10th. "No one is above the law" was the favorite refrain of Democrats as they pursued Donald Trump uphill and down Dale in an effort to destroy his first presidency and ensure he would never serve again. They threw everything at him, manufacturing intelligence to frame him as a Russian stooge, weaponizing the FBI and DOJ against him, impeaching him, sicking the most unscrupulous prosecutors on him, contriving spurious civil cases against him and his family, trying to jail him and bankrupt him, all the while lying and assassinating his character. If that didn't bring him down, two assassination attempts would have finished off a lesser mortal. But, sadly for Trump's Democrat deep state persecutors, they failed spectacularly. They decimated their own party and destroyed the reputations of the intelligence agencies and the mainstream media, allies that aided and abetted their crooked schemes. As the saying goes, if you come for the king, you'd best not miss. Now, accountability is afoot. The next heading is "Illegitimate President," in quotes. On Thursday, Attorney General Pam Bondi appointed pitbull lawyer Ed Martin as a special attorney to lead investigations of New York Attorney General Letitia James and California Senator Adam Schiff for potential charges including mortgage fraud, bank fraud, and wire fraud, which carry jail terms of up to 30 years. Grand juries in Virginia and Maryland are weighing criminal indictments against the two Trump-deranged Democrats over allegations they falsified property records to secure favorable loans. The Albany U.S. attorney has also reportedly issued subpoenas in a separate civil rights investigation into James, including whether her office violated Trump's rights in a lawsuit she brought against him. James has sued Trump, his children, and his businesses dozens of times. She ran for office vowing to, quote, "take on," unquote, the man she called an illegitimate president. For his part, Schiff abused his position as House Intelligence Committee chairman to manipulate and distort intelligence to damage Trump. He created false narratives about Trump's connections to Russia and Ukraine, which led to his first impeachment. Schiff has been the most enthusiastic Democrat to use the phrase, "No one is above the law." Now, he's about to find out the hard way. Meanwhile, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard has spent months extracting documents from hidden reaches of the intelligence agencies and declassifying them against the wishes of the embedded deep staters at the CIA and FBI, whose ruse is to redact documents to the point of indecipherability. Too bad. Gabbard went to the White House to overrule these resistance guerrillas and successfully expose the truth about Russiagate and Barack Obama's role as ringleader, to use Trump's word. We now know that on December 9th, 2016, Obama directed his national security officials, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, CIA Director John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and others to create an intelligence assessment with a foregone conclusion they all knew to be false, that Russia had influenced the 2016 election to help Trump win. And here we have a quote from Ms. Gabbard. Documentation that came from the Obama White House, documentation that came from Obama's ODNI, documentation from the CIA, all of these pieces fit quite seamlessly together, creating a very clear timeline that shifted from before the election, when the intelligence community almost uniformly said essentially that Russia is trying to sow discord in the U.S. election, but has no preference for one candidate over another. Gabbard told me, the author, last week on Pod Force One. And this quote continues, and then all of a sudden, Trump wins the election, surprising many people, both here and abroad, and the Obama officials falsely claim that Russia aspired to help Trump get elected, or that Russia hacked the election in favor of Donald Trump, really trying to discredit President Trump's win and give a big middle finger to the American people who had just voted him into office. She continued, President Obama, unhappy with the outcome of the election and making the appearance of a peaceful transition of power, and claiming to be the champion of democracy, yet he launched what we now know was a covert mission to subvert the will of the American people, create this lie that would challenge the legitimacy of President Trump's election, resulting in what was truly a years-long coup. Those are the words of Tulsi Gabbard. Ms. Gabbard believes that the only way to stop such a travesty from happening again is to punish the wrongdoers. She said, quote, accountability has to take place. We've referred all the documents we have found and will continue to refer them to the Department of Justice for a criminal referral. And let's see, this is also part of the quote. AG, meaning Attorney General Pam Bondi, has created a strike force team focused singularly on bringing accountability to those who are responsible for this. We also have to recognize that Brennan and Clapper have their own disciples, and many of those people still exist within the intelligence community now. So in these documents that we're finding, we are uncovering names of people who were involved with this Russia hoax, this manufactured intelligence document, who would otherwise never be known publicly, unquote. Those, again, are the words of Tulsi Gabbard. And it goes on in the article to say accountability equals deterrence. It's why we have jails. Without punishment, wrongdoers are emboldened. They regard mercy as weakness to be exploited. That's the lesson we take from the behavior of Trump's antagonists over the last 9 years. Despite efforts to paint Trump as a vengeful madman, hell-bent on retribution, the truth is clear from his first term. His tendency is to let bygones be bygones. He won in 2016. He didn't feel the need to drag the vanquished opponent through the mud. Even though at his rallies, his supporters would chant, "Lock her up." Mr. Trump said, quote, "We had Ms. Clinton down for whatever we wanted to do with her, but I felt it was inappropriate." And Trump told that to the author, and again, the author was Miranda Devine, in Scotland 2 weeks ago. Trump went on, "She was the wife of a president. She was a secretary of state. And we could have done a very big number on her. But the concept of putting her in jail, indicting her, all the things that you have to do, it's tough stuff. And I said, we don't want to do that," unquote. He showed Hillary mercy because he wanted the country to heal from the discord of the Obama years. But he went on to say, "And yeah, they did that to me," confessing to her feeling a little bit angry after his mercy was rewarded by being dragged through the mud for years. And Mr. Trump went on, "So I feel differently. I mean, I'm a human being. I have my feelings too. Obama, what he did was terrible. What Brennan did, and Clapper, and Comey, and all these lightweights did was so unnecessary. And they made it really hard. We had a great first term," Trump said, "but it certainly made it less comfortable," unquote. Trump and his current administration understand the need for heads on pikes to act as a deterrent and ultimately to restore public trust in our national security institutions. Now the hunters are the hunted. Every tool is being used to find wrongdoers and bring them to account in a lawful, systematic, administration-wide effort. At least some of the plotters are sure to see the inside of a jail cell. None will sleep easily. And again, this is from the New York Post by Miranda Devine, published August 10th, 2025. Now, the endless debate about COVID continues. And here we have from LifeSite News an article, "New York City teachers who refused COVID jab petition Supreme Court to get their jobs back." This is by Doug Mainwaring, August 9th, 2025. Attorneys representing multiple religious New York City educators have filed a petition for the U.S. Supreme Court in a case known as Kane versus City of New York, asking it to review a lower court decision that denied the educators' ability to live and work according to their religious beliefs. The educators are challenging a city mandate that required them to receive a vaccination in conflict with their deeply religious beliefs. I'm going to jump down a little bit in the interest of time. Michael Kane, the chief petitioner, leader of Teachers for Choice, described the actions as, "This situation is so bad, we have no choice but to seek relief from the highest court in the nation. This isn't something that's going away," Kane previously told LifeSite News. "This isn't something that people have forgotten. This is one of the worst civil rights violations of this century," he declared. "Democrats want to pretend it never happened, but that's not happening." On July 21st, 2025, attorneys with Alliance Defending Freedom, Children's Health Defense, and Nelson Madden Black filed a petition for a writ of certiorari, cert petition, with the Supreme Court of the United States on behalf of 19 fired, unvaccinated educators from New York City. This is combined the original Kane versus de Blasio and Keel versus City of New York cases into a single petition. Well, the rest is rather technical, so I'll skip that. But if you want to read it all, just go to LifeSite News, search for it on the date of August 9th, 2025. New York teachers who refused COVID jab petition Supreme Court to get their jobs back. And now, another COVID-related item, also from LifeSite News. Trump administration ends Biden-era vaccine discrimination. Audits purge of federal COVID jab records. And the subtitle says, Biden's COVID vaccine mandate applied to 2.1 million government employees and millions of private sector employees with contracts working with the government. This is by Doug Mainwaring, Saturday, August 9th, 2025. In a move to further reverse the, quote, many harmful policies of the Biden-Harris administration, unquote, the Trump administration on Friday ordered federal agencies to delete all records related to the COVID-19 vaccination status of government employees. Here we have a quote. Effective immediately, federal agencies may not use an individual's COVID-19 vaccine status, history of noncompliance with prior COVID-19 vaccine mandates, or requests for exemptions from such mandates and any employment-related decisions, including but not limited to hiring, promotion, discipline, or termination, unquote. That was written by Scott Cupor, K-U-P-O-R, Director, U.S. Office of Personnel Management, in a memo to the heads of the federal departments and agencies. And Cupor said in a statement, things got out of hand during the pandemic, and federal workers were fired, punished, or sidelined for simply making a personal medical decision, unquote. And, of course, we know people that that has happened to. A beloved doctor that will ask you to continue to pray for him up in the Philadelphia area. Haven't heard from him for a couple of weeks, so I assume he's okay. But pray for his health and his job opportunities. He was one that had to leave his job, a fine position. But just because he wouldn't take a untried COVID shot, that we now know to be the cause of a lot of illnesses and deaths. Just because he wouldn't do that, they fired him, dismissed him. And he is only one of many, many, many people that this happened to. Now back to the article. Agencies have until September 8th, 2025 to comply with the OPM directive. OPM is Office of Personnel Management. And here we have another quote. Since returning to office, Trump has eliminated federal vaccine mandates, scrapped testing requirements for on-site work, and rescinded mask policies across all executive agencies, explained the Washington Examiner's Samantha Jo Ross. His administration, this is continuing to quote now, his administration has characterized these policies as, quote, government overreach, unquote, that infringed on personal freedoms and disrupted federal operations, unquote. In September 2021, then-President Joe Biden mandated the COVID-19 vaccine for all federal employees, federal contractors, and healthcare workers at facilities that received Medicare or Medicaid funding. Biden's mandate applied to 2.1 million government employees and millions of private sector employees with contractors working with the government. Federal employees risked losing their jobs if they chose to remain unvaccinated. The move by Trump's OPM comes after Feds for Freedom announced earlier this week that the group had reached a landmark settlement with the Department of Justice. This settlement, and this is from the group's press release, this settlement marks a significant victory for individual rights and serves as a powerful implicit acknowledgement of the government's overreach achieved through Feds for Freedom's relentless pursuit of justice. And it goes on to say, our victory is a long overdue confirmation of what we've asserted all along. COVID mandates were unconstitutional, immoral, and un-American, said Feds for Freedom President Marcus Staunton. He went on to say, patriotic Americans, including Feds for Freedom, proudly held the line against an unprecedented attack on our most basic freedom, spanning years, relentless assault by petty tyrants determined to destroy our constitutional republic. That again was from the White Site News on Saturday, August 9th. Trump administration ends Biden-era vaccine discrimination. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but let me say again, we still have a few of the books left, COVID and Coming Chaos. Those books are free. I will be happy to mail you one out to you. It would be helpful if you put just a little bit of money in, even just $5, to cover postage. I can send it media mail for just about that amount. So if you just write to me and ask me for the book, I will get it right out to you. And my address is Lou, L-O-U, Caverly, C-A-V, as in Victor, E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. I'll repeat that later, but it's Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And we can always use some of your contributions. If you can mail that to the same address, we'd be most grateful, keeping the program on the air. Also, if you want to go to our website, I'm going to be updating it real soon, putting some new articles in. But the website, and it contains all the information about the various ways you can hear this program. Some of you may be hearing in shortwave on Thursday evenings at 8 p.m., 4.840 megahertz. That's 4.840. Some like to hear it Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on 7.490 megahertz. But all of these various ways to hear it at our website. And the website is DividedKingdomRadio.com. DividedKingdomRadio.com. There are some other ways you can hear it too. Global Star. You can hear it there. A number of other websites. A lady who has been diligent and so very, very helpful, named Angel. She has been keeping the website going for many years as volunteer work. She doesn't take a salary for that, just out of the kindness of her heart and loving the Lord. And she has been very good. There was a time after Elizabeth's death when I really did get behind, and not the archives, although we did have some problems with those, but I think they're up and running now. But I didn't really have the energy and time to give little summaries where it says on our website, past shows. But I think I've got that back in the swing of things now. I don't know if I'll ever be able to get all the old ones done, but the most current ones should be up and running now. And then you can see a little bit of some of the topics on the program. So kind of a quick summary. Well, let's move on now to an article. I was up at my in-laws in South Central Pennsylvania for a nice festival over the weekend. And whenever I go up to that area of Pennsylvania, I always like to get a local newspaper just for the fun of it. I really don't know many people there except my relatives, really my in-laws, but it's always fun just to see another part of the country. It's a rural area for the most part. There is one fair-sized city, Bedford, not too far from Greasewood, in the general direction from my way of Pittsburgh. This was an article that probably is appearing in many papers, and it's called AI Chatbots Safe for Your Children. And this is by Joanna Parger Malinke, MD, and FAAP. I had to look up FAAP, and it has to do with the pediatricians. I can't remember the exact name now, but if you'll get up on the internet, you'll find it. And she has a number of good credentials. I'll list a few of them at the end. You can find her on a number of websites. So this is a very good authority on this. Now, I'll read at least a portion of this. Artificial intelligence chatbots are now a part of daily life for many families. As you make dinner, maybe you realize you're out of an ingredient. So you ask a smart speaker but you can use instead. Or you may have trouble assembling a product you bought. For help, you chat with a virtual service agent online. But children and teens increasingly turn to chatbots for entertainment or companionship. That's when these computer programs designed to interact with humans or like humans can be risky for young users. Companies are investing a lot of time and money into growing AI platforms and chatbots that are not made with kids in mind. This means that chatbots may tell kids false, harmful, highly sexual, or violent things. As we collectively work to put up safety guidelines for this, or guide rails for this new technology, it's important for families to understand this technology and ways to protect young people. Chatbots are AI-driven. They're computer programs that listen to us and respond in friendly human ways. They, quote-unquote, learn how to speak and write naturally by absorbing what we say, and millions of others might tell them. Advanced chatbots help users create characters that can talk for hours, giving the impression they are caring friends. Companion chatbots use anthropomorphic AI with human-like voices, personalities, and conversational styles. They can seem almost alive, or like a trusted friend. This is especially the case for kids and teens who have more magical, less critical thinking. One of the fun and incredible things about kids and teens is they are more magical thinkers than adults. This means that they become more attached to parasocial relationships. And those parasocial relationships involve a connection between a person and someone they do not know well, a phenomenon AI can fuel. Children and teens can become very attached to and trust their AI avatars or online personalities that they construct. They can get drawn in by a bot that seems to really understand them. At a time when people feel more lonely than ever, it might not be surprising that kids are turning to chatbots for friendly advice and for friendship. This becomes troublesome when you realize that even though they respond in warm, friendly ways, they don't care about our children. One thing AI can never do is be a substitute for the safe, stable, and nurturing relationships that children need to grow. Unlike humans, chatbots don't have a sense of duty to protect kids. They only know what they learn from the internet and other users. This is one reason they might give false, threatening, misleading, violent, or overly sexual answers and advice to young users. Chatbots aren't required to sift through multiple sources and figure out what information seems trustworthy. They can misguide children or advise them to take dangerous actions based on scant knowledge of a given subject. Chatbots also don't know a child's life story. Young or sensitive kids, those who are developmentally delayed, or those living with trauma or medical health issues, might be more open to their influence. It's important to discuss AI chatbot use with your children. Ask whether they use chatbots for fun or friendship, which platforms they like most, and if it has ever said anything creepy or false to them. Take a calm, curious approach so they feel safe telling you about their experiences. You're just looking together at your child's chats with a bot to help them identify anything you think is inappropriate. And in the interest of time, I'm going to have to cut it off there, but this author obviously has some very good ideas. Her name is spelled Joanna, P-A-R-G-A-B-E-L-I-N-K-I-E. She is a neonatologist or baby doctor. She does clinical work in both the neonatal intensive care unit and in the newborn nursery with healthy babies. Dr. Pagra Belenke works in Philadelphia, where she is the director of a newborn nursery at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. So there's a few other things there, but I'll have to stop there. But again, very good author. She has things online and things about her online, and you can probably find this very article or something very much like it on the Internet. Again, her name is Joanna Parga, P-A-R-G-A, dash, Belenke, B-E-L-I-N-K-I-E. All right, we'll move away from that for the time being. Well, let me see now. A little humorous article, but not so humorous after all, from Zero Hedge. Eco-loons suggest proliferating a plague of ticks to prevent people from eating meat. This is by Tyler Durden, Tuesday, August 12, 2025. And it says, authored by Chris Morrison via dailyskeptic.org. Perhaps it's a drinking or smoking game at Western Michigan University. Try to come up with the most farcical, April Fool-style net zero nonsense and see if we can get it published. How about writing a paper titled Beneficial Blood Sucking that states it is morally obligatory. That's in quotes, by the way. Morally obligatory to promote a plague of the Lone Star tick, whose bite can lead to medical problems, including an allergy to red meat. Oh, and it could kill you. But more about that later. Promoting these ghastly ticks, which are already increasing in numbers in large areas of the United States, is said to, quote, prevent the world from becoming a significantly worse place. Doesn't violate anyone's rights. Promotes virtuous action or character, unquote. How stupid can academics be? These clowns are prepared to unleash a proliferation of ticks on the general population because one side effect of a bite happens to induce an allergy to red meat, notably beef, pork, and lamb. What is proposed is a deliberate tick injection of the sugar molecule alpha-gal, G-A-L, into human tissue, leading to an immune defense response causing a syndrome known as AGS. This leads to potentially fatal allergic reactions to red meat and many associated products, including dairy products, such as milk, cheese, yogurt, and butter. Gelatin is also a problem, so no treats for children, since it is found in many favorable brands of candy. It is not just mammalian products that cause problems. Alpha-gal-like structures have been found in carrageenan, a seaweed-derived thickener used in some processed food, and in a number of medicines. It is feasible to genetically edit the disease-carrying capacity of ticks, state the authors of this article. And here's a quote from them. If we are right, then today we have the obligation to research and develop the capacity to proliferate tick-borne AGS, and tomorrow carry out that proliferation, they add. Tick-borne AGS is said by these maniacs to be a moral bioenhancer. So who are these Temple of Learning thickos, these climate-bothering cretins, who are promoting a widespread net-zero fantasy to abolish the eating of meat? Step forward, Parker Crutchfield, professor in the Department of Medical Ethics, Humanities, and Law at Western Michigan University, Warner, McLeod, Homer, Stryker, MD School of Medicine. And he's also an adjunct professor in the philosophy department. And our second bright spark is Blake Harreth, H-E-R-E-T-H. And he is an assistant professor at the university's Medical Ethics School. This is Lou speaking now. Look at all these ethics guys. ethics to give people a disease? I wouldn't have thought so. But back to the article, of course, the full force of investigative journalist techniques have been employed to assert the paper is genuine and not some bored academic's idea of its black. It appears to be 100% genuine and has been published in the John Wiley publication, Bioethics. Just to be sure, it can be confirmed that Western Michigan University exists, although annual in-state tuition fees of $15,000 seem a little steep if this anti-human tosh is an example of the teaching on offer. Alpha-gal syndrome is a growing concern in the United States and many other parts of the world, notably Australia. According to the Center for Disease Control, AGS is a, quote, serious, potentially life-threatening tick-borne allergy. The CDC suggests that between 2010 and 2022, nearly 450,000 people may have been affected. The numbers appear to have been rising due to better diagnosis and an expanding range of the Lone Star tick. From a southern base, the tick is moving northwards, and there have been reports of bites in New York and Pennsylvania. High-risk areas are centered around the southeast and Midwest. There is currently no vaccine or treatment available, and the usual defenses against insect bites, such as repellent and wearing covering clothing, are suggested. AGS can significantly impact the quality of life of sufferers. The allergic reaction can involve symptoms, including hives, itching, stomach pain, lowered blood pressure, or, in severe cases, anaphylaxis. There have been deaths recorded due to AGS, primarily involving medical products containing alpha-gal, such as pituximab and heparin. Pituximab is a cancer treatment drug used widely in oncology, while heparin is a life-saving blood anticoagulant that is stable in emergency centers and hospitals around the world. There are reported to be at least 10 deaths attributed to alpha-gal reactions to medical products, with most fatalities due to anaphylactic shock. It appears that no deaths have been directly linked to AGS and red meat consumption, but with cases on the rise recently, this could be due to unreported or misdiagnosed cases. AGS is a serious and growing threat, but manageable as a public health issue. That is, unless these net zero nutters at Western Michigan are allowed to set or even influence public policy. Interesting article with a lot of good facts, besides the somewhat humorous approach at times. Once again, that was from Zero Hedge, ZeroHedge.com. Ecoloon suggests proliferating a plague of ticks, etc. And that was on Tuesday, August 12th, if you'd like to get it printed up. Well, let's see what we have here. All right, from the Washington Times. Why Americans aren't having children. And this was a commentary and an opinion by Timothy S. Goldlein, I guess how you pronounce it. His name is spelled G-O-E-G-L-E-I-N, on Sunday, August 10th, 2025. For years, we heard about the population bomb that was going to lead to the demise of our planet. After years of doomsayers, such as the late Paul Ehrlich, ranting about how all the overpopulation is going to destroy our world, the exact opposite is now happening. Rather than having too many children, people are not having enough children to sustain the future of our planet. The United Nations Population Fund just released an alarming report on the global fertility crisis. A demographic cliff that is especially acute in first world countries, such as the USA. Much of this global depopulation crisis can be potentially tied to the efforts of the United Nations, Planned Parenthood, and others to limit population growth through, quote, family planning, unquote, and in many cases, abortion. Although the U.S. report cites the usual factors, all of which have validity, such as financial limitations, it does state that one in four adults said they felt, quote, unable to have a child at their preferred time, unquote, and one in five reported, quote, being pressured to have children they did not want, unquote. Thus, the UN doubles down on its abortion advocacy, saying that one of the solutions is to lift restrictions on reproductive rights. In first world places such as the USA and Europe, lower population growth will eventually lead to weaker economies, as there will not be enough available workers, and those who do work will not number enough to provide for expensive entitlements for aging generations. For instance, the current fertility replacement rate in the U.S. is around 1.6, down from 2.1 in the mid-2000s. Meanwhile, improved health care, a good thing, is keeping people alive longer, exacerbating the population gap between the young and the aged. Other studies have found that one in three Gen Z and millennial generation members either do not have or do not want to have children. These are alarming statistics, but it is based on the view promoted by Ehrlich and others that human beings are a burden on rather than a benefit to societal well-being. Well, in the interest of time, let me just skip down a little bit here. After reviewing several new books, Jennifer Fry, who was the dean of the Honors College at the University of Tulsa, stated that she found that statistics show that only 26% of Americans say having children is important for living a fulfilling life, compared with 71% who said they would choose having a job or career they enjoy, and 61% who say close friends will bring fulfillment. Well, I'll stop there, but there's more if you want to read it all. And the author of that article, Timothy S. Goeglein, I guess is how you pronounce it, G-O-E-G-L-E-I-N, is Vice President of External and Government Relations for Focus on the Family. He served as Special Assistant to President George W. Bush and is the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. Again, that was from the Washington Times, Why Americans Aren't Having Children, by dated Sunday, August 10th. Of this year. Now, here's a little article of interest. Those who have an archaeological bent and just like to read about things in the ancient world. On Fox News, researchers discover 2,500-year-old honey residue in ancient bronze jars. And the subtitle says, ancient residue found in Italy has a slight tang, but bears little resemblance to today's honey, say the experts. This is by Andrea Margolis, Fox News, August 12, 2025. Researchers recently made a sticky discovery. They found 2,500-year-old honey sealed in a vessel and buried underground for nearly three millennia. The residue was found in bronze jars at an underground shrine in Paestum, an ancient Greek settlement in modern-day Campania, Italy. The artifacts date back to the 6th century B.C. The jars were first found by archaeologists in 1954, but the residue in them has eluded experts until now. In a study published by the American Chemical Society on July 30th, experts concluded that the wavy residue was once honey. Luciana Carvalho, a research associate at the University of Oxford, told Fox News Digital, the substance bears little resemblance to the golden honey in most modern-day cupboards. She said, ancient honey was quite different from the clear, smooth honey we buy today. There was no ultrafiltration, no pasteurization, and no synthetic pesticides in the landscape, unquote. The chemical results strongly, and that's in quotes, strongly suggested that the jars held raw honeycomb, rather than a blended product like most modern honey. And Miss Margolis, I believe that was her name, let me check, no, Miss Carvalho, stated, furthermore, if honey had been mixed with milk, for example, we would expect to see extra fatty acids in the residue, and we don't. And it goes on in the article, but the raw honeycomb has dramatically changed over the millennia. Along with fellow researchers, Elizabeth Perez and James McConnor, Carvalho found that the sugar gradually became dark and acidic. After 2,500 years, almost all the original sugars have broken down and been eaten by microbes, so the residue isn't sweet anymore. The sugars slowly reacted with proteins in a kind of slow-motion browning process, similar to what happens when bread bakes, turning it darker and more acidic, she said. Because of that, the remaining residue isn't exactly pleasant to eat, according to the experts. What survives now, and this is Ms. Carvalho again, what survives now is a waxy residue with a slight tang and virtually no sweetness. After 2,500 years, almost all the original sugars have broken down and been eaten by microbes, so the residue isn't sweet anymore. I believe I repeated that. As for the vessels, Carvalho said the bronze jars have cork discs that seal their necks, which points to, quote, careful storage of something valuable, unquote. The copper alloy jugs were found in a sealed underground shrine, suggesting that they were left there as part of a ritual. And she said, quote, inside, the residue clung to the bottom and sides, exactly what you'd expect if raw honeycomb had been placed inside and slowly dried up over centuries. We hope our approach will be used to identify honey residues in other museum collections so we can learn more about ancient beekeeping and the role of honey in diet, medicine, and ritual life. Researchers in the 1980s previously believed that the honey was a mixture of wax, fat, and resin, with Carvalho noting that past research was limited by less precise tools. Well, it goes on, but let me kind of summarize here. We hope our approach, and this is Ms. Carvalho again, we hope our approach will now be used to identify honey residues in other museum collections so we can learn more about ancient beekeeping and the role of honey in diet, medicine, and ritual life, as Carvalho said. The latest research adds to a number of ancient food-related discoveries this year, which are extremely rare occurrences. That, again, was from Fox News by Andrea Margolis, August 12, 2025. Researchers discovered 2,500-year-old honey residue in ancient bronze jars. Now, we don't have time to go into this in any depth tonight. Our time is winding down, but there was an interesting article. Some of you may be familiar with the Shrouded Term. It's been a topic of controversy for centuries. Some think it's the burial shroud of Jesus Christ. Others think it's a hoax or possibly a work of art. Although, I must admit, I don't know what to think about it. The Catholic Church keeps it on display at a cathedral in Turin, Italy, hence the name Shroud of Turin. But the Catholic Church has never made a declarative statement whether they believe it's real or not, as the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And this article, which you might want to look up, came from LifeSite News. The title was Tucker Carlson Interviews Shroud of Turin Expert, Proving the Resurrection of Jesus is Real. And I note that he's a Protestant Bible scholar, not Catholic, so he has no axe to grind in that respect. He has some very interesting evidence, and if time permits, next week I'll go into that in a little bit of depth. Things like the position of the wounds and the image in the shroud, the fact that the shroud is a photographic negative. Dark appears light, light appears dark. And you wonder how would an artist been able to paint that if it was just a painting? How would he have had the expert of knowledge to make that work? It wasn't until the very late 1800s that a photographer, once photography was invented and could be brought to bear on this shroud, he photographed it, and when he developed his negatives, not the positive final product, but the negatives, he suddenly saw this image that he didn't realize was there. Now, they didn't realize it was some sort of an image, but they could not see much detail to it. Well, very interesting topic. You will find tons of information on the Internet. I looked up just a little bit a short time ago, and frankly, I realized I didn't know enough about this to give a good presentation. But if you'd like to look it up, it's in LifeSite News. Perhaps I'll go into it next week. LifeSite News, Tucker Carlson interviews Shroud of Turin expert, and the date was Monday, August 11th. The author was Andreas Waelzer, W-A-I-L-Z-E-R. Well, our time is pretty much up for today. I want to thank you all for listening. Pray for those who need special prayers. I'm going to ask for some prayers for a young man. I don't know his name. Probably wouldn't give it over the radio anyway, but he was in a terrible motorcycle accident. And we don't know if he'll pull through or not. He was in West Virginia. And at the event I went to this past weekend, there was a similar accident. Fortunately, the man did survive and make some very wonderful paintings now. So we're hoping for the best, and we ask your prayers for this young man. Well, I hear our music coming on. I want to thank you for listening. Go to our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. Write to me, Lou Caroli, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, just like the Bethlehem in the Bible, spelled the same way, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week, and good night. We'll be right back.